This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us on this Main Street Monday across the state of North Dakota with spring blooming everywhere. We're going to talk today about a serious subject at the start of our show, colon cancer. It is, you can screen for it, you can find it, you can detect it, and you can treat it, but the trick is screening for it early enough and getting the right kind of treatment, I guess. We've got a couple of people to talk about this and orient us about a special presentation this evening in Fargo called The Fight Against Colon Cancer, Screening and Treatment. Douglas and Michelle Mahoney are both biostatisticians for the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Thank you for being with us, Michelle.
Thank you very much.
And you, Douglas.
Thank you very much.
Why is colon cancer the second leading cause of cancer-related death in the country, Douglas?
Unfortunately, colon cancer is detected in about 60% of the people too late, where there's advanced disease or the symptoms are so advanced that there's no chance or little chance for a cure.
And Michelle, does that mean that those symptoms present themselves when they could have been detected much earlier?
Yes, they could have been detected, I think, a little bit earlier. I think it's people being aware of what's happening in their body and staying in touch with their physicians and then following the screening recommendations that are forward and using things such as the Cologuard that Doug is here to speak about.
Well, I've heard about the colonoscopy. That's a matter of joking, I guess, among people who reach a certain age, whether it's 50 or whatever the age is, when you're supposed to start having these regular colonoscopy screens. Doug, give us a little background about how we do screen for colon cancer.
Yeah, right now, by far, colonoscopy starting at age 50 is the recommendation to get screened for colon cancer. And colonoscopy has led that screening for many, many years. And now what's available is Cologuard as well. This is for people that are at average risk. It comes with a prescription from your physician. And really, people that really do not want to have a colonoscopy, this is a test that you can do at home. You provide your stool in a container. It's shipped to the company for analysis. And the results of the test are shipped, mailed directly back to your primary care physician to talk about the next step.
How does it compare to a colonoscopy in terms of its accuracy?
So relative to a colonoscopy, we are sitting at about 90% specificity and 94% sensitivity. So that means 94% of all cancers are being detected by Cologuard.
Wow. That seems to be quite an improvement, Michelle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I have seen advertisements for something like this on television. Is this available now?
It is FDA approved and it's available. It's covered by Medicare, and many, many of the insurance programs also will cover it.
Michelle, give us a little bit of background here. What is a biostatistician, and how do you work in the research area at the Mayo Clinic?
Yep. So I've been a biostatistician since 1994. I have a master's degree in applied statistics, and right now I'm working on clinical trials in cancer research. And so I'm more the treatment end of things for this, and I help investigators design their trials to answer the questions in cancer research, and with a certain amount of precision. And then I monitor the studies and analyze them and publish them.
Now, when we hear about clinical trials, I guess there's kind of this ethical conundrum that pops up in my head. I'm thinking, who gets the trial? Who gets to take the chance at maybe success and who doesn't? How does this work?
So the last figure that I had heard is about 10% of patients that are diagnosed with cancer actually participate on clinical trials. In 2016, Congress passed the 21st Century Cure Act, which is called the Cancer Moonshot, and it is making efforts to get treatments to patients faster, which includes enrollment on clinical trials. We have eligibility criteria to participate on clinical trials. Of course, we want to make sure that you're not too sick to participate in a study that's investigating a toxic regimen, potentially. And we are moving more to the era of loosening up that criteria to allow more people to come into clinical trials. And making actually the results of the trials maybe a little more real world to what you'll see out in the real world setting. Clinical trials are highly controlled to protect patients from toxic side effects. And so when a drug actually makes it to market or a treatment combination makes it to market, it opens it up to a more broad population. And so we're trying to allow those patients to come onto those studies more and have more access to that.
Douglas, you mentioned the fact that there's this new at-home detection system, Cologuard. And, of course, we've had the colonoscopies for a long time out there. As a biostatistician, do you study why people choose not to do something like that might save their lives?
Well, there are many studies that have been conducted that look at that. And many of it revolves around having to miss, on average, 2 days of work to get a colonoscopy. Some people just cannot afford that. The other issue is kind of fear of the colonoscopy itself. Everyone has this perception of it being very unpleasant, having to go through a very unpleasant preparation process. I think those are by far the two biggest areas of not having a colonoscopy done for screening.
And just so that our listeners can get an appreciation for the importance of it, what is the colon cancer can take a while to to really get going.
Yep.
So early screening does make a difference. Is there a time period that you could suggest to people? I mean, typically you get your first one at 50 and your next one so many years later and da-da-da.
Right. So I think if you have your colonoscopy at 50 and there's no significant highly dysplastic lesions found, you can go on a 10-year cycle. But if there's something found that is precancerous, they're going to want more frequent colonoscopies done, possibly every 5 years then.
And Michelle, you mentioned you're looking at these clinical trials for treatments. As a biostatistician, do you get any kind of a sense of what these treatments are?
Yes, and we do have a little bit of say into the treatment combinations that we're looking at and actually really working closely with the investigators and even the National Cancer Institute in terms of designing these trials. What I will say through the research that I've been part of and observed over the years in colon cancer is that we have taken the 5-year disease-free survival rate after removing the cancer in your body from 50% prior to 1980, being alive and disease-free at 5 years, up to 75%.
That's quite an improvement.
Yep. And in terms of advanced disease that's unresectable, in 1980, only about 5% of patients were alive at 5 years, and now we've raised that bar over 30%. So we are making strides, even though, you know, it may not be detected soon enough. We are making strides with all the treatment and the research that we're doing.
Now, when we talk about cancer, we usually think of like three kinds of treatment. There's the surgical one, remove the cancerous tumor element. There's the chemical one, chemotherapy, and then there's the radiation one. Are you looking at all of these?
We are, and it really very much depends on the stage of cancer when you are told that you have colon cancer. Do you have earlier stages that have not gone deep into the wall of the colon, or do you have advanced disease where it's actually burst through the wall of the colon and moved to other organs? So early stage cancer, we first do surgery, and if we can get that all out, then we will give some chemotherapy to stop micrometastases that are maybe somewhere else in your body or in the same area from growing and developing more cancer. As we move to later stage, and we'll also try some radiation, I should say, as well. As we move to later stages of cancer, we're really trying to stop the growth of what's there. We can't remove it all, but we need to stop or slow down that growth and hopefully prolong your life without problems with disease progression as well as just your life in general. And that's where we see first-line treatment, meaning what is the first treatment you'll be given. Then if you fail that treatment, there's another option and another option. And so there's a lot of options, but it all depends on the stage of cancer that you have when you are actually told you're diagnosed that you have colon cancer.
And we mentioned those three prominent ones that everybody sort of knows about, surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy. But there's another kind of science that's emerging out there that's sort of this genetic approach or this way of looking at cancer in a new way.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, that is where we're headed right now, is we're moving towards personalized medicine. So I'll talk about biomarkers. If there is a biomarker that is actually present in your tumor and it's normal, you may be getting one certain kind of treatment. In colon cancer, we know that for resected disease is FOLFOX, a combination called FOLFOX. However, if you have a gene mutation of KRAS, you may get another treatment because that one is actually harmful for you or shows no benefit. So we're really moving to try to identify the characteristics of the genes within the tumor to better match a treatment that will work for that tumor.
And Douglas, are there screening procedures that are going to be looking in that direction then?
There definitely is, and I just would add one of the other options that is out there is xenograft studies where cells from a cancer are put into a mouse, for example, and several mice grow the tumor, breast cancer, whatever, and they try several different treatments on the mice to see which treatment is working best for that particular cancer for that subject.
So you've got a laboratory animal that's sort of testing out the what they're going to try out on you.
Yes, absolutely.
And so you talked about this Cologuard, which is an in-home way to detect or to screen for colon cancer. Is this where a lot of screening is going to go? You won't be going into a clinic necessarily? Or?
Well, I think it's going more towards wet science is what we call it. And, for example, plasma testing. Mm-hmm. I think a large part of the competition for discovering biomarkers is in the plasma arena. And we ourselves, after our success with Cologuard, are looking at the top 16 cancer killers now and trying to develop a test that will, A, do you have cancer or not? And, B, if you do, where is it located?
Wow, that would be thrilling and life-changing for a lot of people.
We often say we're trying to change the world and trying to change medicine. And for many of the vascular cancers, we're having very high success right now.
Well, if you're interested in the research and in specifically the colon cancer connections to this discussion, I encourage you to take in The Fight Against Colon Cancer, Screening and Treatment. It's the annual community lecture by NDSU's College of Science and Mathematics. It's this evening at 7 o'clock at the Fargo Theater. I assume it's free and open to the public. Mm-hmm. And it'll cover new, accurate, and easy screening tests, the most effective current treatments, and the future of colon cancer research, and for that matter, cancer research in general, because this is a very intriguing field that we've really just scratched the surface of.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being with us today, Michelle Mahoney.
Thank you.
And Douglas Mahoney.
Thank you.
Statisticians, biostatisticians with the Department of Health Sciences Research from NDSU. They're now with the Mayo Clinic. And again, that lecture this evening at 7 at the Fargo Theater. Coming up, The Cutting Ed.
In a special family concert Sunday, May 6th at 3 p.m., the Missouri Valley Chamber Orchestra brings to the capital city Blessings from the Children by Gwyneth Walker. This chorus and orchestra work will feature the Jubilate Chorus from Central Dakota Children's Choir. Other works on the program include Three Billy Goats Gruff for narrator and string quintet, and The Tin Forest, using recycled items for instruments, by Minnesota composer Steve Heitzig. The concert is conducted by Dennis Gawin with Don Hagerot and takes place at House of Prayer Lutheran Church in South Bismarck. Tickets are available at the door.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Even though the future remains to be seen, schools aim to prepare students for it. Today in an excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast, host Tom Gerhart learns how the rural North Dakota town of Garrison is embracing education innovation. The movie most likely to succeed made an impression on Superintendent Nick Clemish and Principal Steve Dangle. Now their school is thinking about changing how classes are scheduled.
You arrived at a point where you're considering the flex mod scheduling. So tell us, I guess, first in a big picture sense, Nick, what's happening here at Garrison from that perspective?
Well, the big picture there was, again, getting some buy-in. I mean, even Mr. Dangle here, he was a little reluctant at first, and of course, it's everyone looks at Legacy as, you know, Legacy was designed around this schedule. I mean, it's a beautiful building, and here we are, we're a Class B school and a building built in the 50s. Well, how does this even work? having worked in Oaks for a number of years, knowing the administration there, we reached out to them and just said, what does this look like? Can we bring a group down there? Because right now the big hangup is our building. Well, our building was in the 50s and legacies as Taj Mahal. I said, wait till you go to Oaks. It's a beautiful building, but it was built in the 20s. I said, they're making it work. They're doing it. They're making it happen. So from there, it's just Mr. Dangle and forming a team of people to go down there and view it and observe it, getting people from the school board to parents to teachers and kids to go down and check it out. Right now, we're to the point where we've had two groups go and observe. We've had actually three. We had one group go to the Legacy right away. Then we had, I think, pretty much the same group go down to Oaks and observe that. Mr. Dangle took a good chunk of people last week to Legacy once again, and I'm taking the rest of our teaching staff from the high school next week, along with some more kids and more school board members. Because to me, if we're going to do this, we have to have input from all the people, and our teachers are invaluable when this comes to this process, our students, our board members, because it goes to the unknown again of what does this look like 4 or 5 years down the road, and I can't answer that. But at the same token, it's going to be some of those things that we have to learn and grow and adjust, and it'll be interesting when we present it to groups of parents because it's totally against the norm of the seven-period bell schedule with the bells, and I mean, as the narrator would say, during most likely to succeed, I mean, the whole blue collar model is over. So what do we do now? How do we change that?
Interesting story, Steve, I think that we heard from, and I'd like you to tell it from the student perspective, but Dr. Klemisch mentioned a student that you have here at the school. Great student. Sounds like a great young man who maybe was hesitant about the idea of the transition. Went on a site visit. What did he come away with?
Well, I took three students with me to Oaks, and they had no idea what they were doing. Just kind of said, we're going to go down and look at Oaks. They got kind of a neat schedule. Just kind of want to take you guys with. And I said, you're going to give me honest feedback. So really, that was what they had going down. And we arrived in Oaks, and you know, Brandon sat down with us, and he started kind of explaining the Flex Mod. And he had all his Excel sheets up there. And if you've seen the Excel sheets, it's kind of really overwhelming at times. And he was sitting there, and he goes, so Brandon goes, are you ready to go get a tour of the school? He said, yeah. And so we kind of started walking, and I went up to my student. I said, what do you think so far? And he goes, I don't know. He goes, I'm going to try to keep an open mind, but he goes, I just don't think this is going to work. And so I said, okay. I said, I appreciate that. And we toured the school. We talked with some staff. We talked with some students. It was time for lunch, and so we were walking to the diner at lunchtime, and he comes up to me and goes, hey, Mr. Dangle, think about the tractor class. You know how great this would be for my ag courses? Because, I mean, with the tractor class, I'd have 80 minutes to work on the tractor compared to the 32 minutes we get to work on the tractor. Imagine all the stuff we could get done. And all of a sudden, his mind is just flying, and he's coming up with some ideas. I had another student that went down, and she went bowling with their phy ed class, and she came back. She goes, yeah, I beat them. So, you know, the kids enjoy the process. I haven't, you know, I've taken three kids to Oaks and four to Legacy, and all the kids that have come back say, we like this. This is a good idea. And so the kids are on board. It's what's our staff going to think, and also bringing parents along, and what do they think?
So we've heard a little bit from a student perspective. What are some of the benefits for the teachers? We talked about empowerment.
Well, I think some of the benefits are simply affording them greater time with kids that need the more time. I mean, I come from a block schedule when I was a teacher, which 90 minutes was a great thing for a lot of teachers, but it was a downfall for a lot of teachers because it was 90 minutes. So this way they're given ownership on developing the schedule of saying, well, I need X number of minutes to teach this course. And then the schedule is built around that. So it gives them the opportunity to at least analyze what they do. And on top of it, then we keep talking a lot about our ag program and making the connections with our ag program and any other hands-on programs we have. I think we did a near space science balloon competition this year, which we put it on one of our teachers and she ran with it. Again, very much project based. And her conundrum at the time was, this isn't teaching from the book. But now all of a sudden we have kids who normally wouldn't be invested in an opportunity like this. We have 13 kids that are totally invested in this process and they're being graded on it. And the outcome of it, I mean, going to showcase their space balloon kit, I mean, was totally dynamic in the fact that, hey, they built this. They were able to conduct an experiment at 80,000 feet in the atmosphere. They were able to analyze it, make a report on it. And all of a sudden, hey, the kids that normally wouldn't do this are like, let's do this again. And the teacher basically just got to sit back and watch once the tools were provided and provided a little oversight here and there. And that's the fear of giving the students more control. And, you know, they always say letting the inmates run the asylum, but ultimately that's what we need to do to get the kids ownership. And then cycling it back. Well, what are we truly learning here? Well, did they truly learn a lot about their project? Absolutely. But is it your typical written paper pencil test? No. I mean, you look at normal paper pencil tests. I mean, I think of the thousands of paper I've written over time in college. They're meaningless to me. I couldn't tell you everything I wrote about. I mean, my own dissertation, who's going to read that? It's the most boring thing I've probably ever written. But it was a hoop that I had to jump through. Now it's providing tangible work that we can give kids and say, hey, look at this. We can showcase this. This is awesome. And then it only intrigues others to participate.
Steve, teachers have a lot on their plate. They're asked to do a lot of things in this day and age. You, I'm sure, work closely with them here in Garrison. What have you heard as far as feedback now that you guys are invested in the process anyway?
Well, like I said, for my first five that went with me to Legacy and Oaks, they're fired up. They've come up with ideas and they've come up with plans. And I have, you know, teachers saying, well, class schedules next year because, you know, in spring of the year, start working on class schedules. And, you know, if we go flex mod, let's try this. And, you know, the second group that went there, I would say for the most part, they're on board. I think they have more questions. And so that's the piece we're at. We're still at the fact-finding part of what we're looking into. You know, what's it going to look at? Kind of like what I was talking to one teacher. They said, well, how are we going to have saber time, as they call it, in Legacy, you know, where they have a math resource room? You know, we don't have a math teacher that can go there. I said, well, we do, but you have to reevaluate your time. You know, negotiate agreement says you get a 30-minute duty-free lunch and you get a 50-minute prep period. So you get 80 minutes in a day. There's nothing that says that I have to give you a 50-minute block of time and a 30-minute block of time. You know, you're going to probably get a 40-minute duty-free lunch because we'll do two mods at 20 minutes. And then you might get 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes lit in the late morning. And then in the afternoon, you're going to be in the resource room, the math resource center or the English resource center. So I said it's looking at time in a different way. You're not going to get all that 50 minutes at once like we have now.
You had a parent stop in before we started this interview to talk to Mr. Dangle, mm-hmm. and you said, talking about getting buy-in from the community, mm-hmm. The school board, things like that. What have the nature of those conversations been like, and what kind of feedback have you received?
The gentleman that came earlier today is a very traditional person, and I didn't sit in his full conversation, but knowing of him and knowing of his family, his hang-up isn't so much the schedule. It is a lot of change. But at the end of the day, he looks at his own kids and says, ultimately, this is probably what my kids need. Just because I did it and it worked for me doesn't mean it's a great thing for my own kid. And that's kind of been the consensus amongst a lot of the parents here that have gone and toured it. A board member, he used to live in California, and he's talked about, you know, there's some different opportunities we did in California that, hey, we're still stuck in the traditional rut over here. Well, again, looking at our kids, how do we make those adjustments to keep them hooked and engaged in education?
Host Tom Gerhart talking with Garrison School Superintendent Nick Klemisch and Principal Steve Dangle. The Cutting Ed podcast is produced in collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Dinter-Smith. Coming up, North Dakota's Poetry Out Loud winner in national competition. Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The so-called penny a pill legislation will be considered by a Minnesota State Senate committee tomorrow. Under it, pharmaceutical companies would be charged for every opioid they sell in Minnesota. The money would be used for prevention, treatment, and social services tied to the opioid epidemic. It has run into opposition from pharmaceutical companies and some business groups. The bill's Senate sponsor, Republican Julie Rosen, says talks with drug companies continue about the opioid crisis, but so far the companies have not come up with any constructive funding solutions.
I'm getting tired of the pushback and the lack of true, sincere interest in helping us solve this crisis.
The House version of the bill no longer contains the fee on pharmaceutical companies. It's funded through the state's general fund. As the Farm Bill moves to the U.S. House, legislators are split along party lines over changes to the main federal food aid program. Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports that Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue says it won't hold up its passage.
House Republicans are looking to have millions more food benefit recipients either work or attend job training in the 2018 version of the Farm Bill. But Democrats believe it's more of a punishment than a path to employment. Last week in Denver, Perdue acknowledged the disagreement between camps and how it's affecting the speed with which the bill is moving through Congress. But he said he's confident the bill will pass and is calling on President Donald Trump to help make that happen.
Well, obviously, he's a big person to rely on. And when he puts his shoulder to the grind there in Congress, then typically things happen.
Perdue said more food benefit recipients should be required to work as a favor to American taxpayers and so that they can become self-sufficient. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
And a spokesman for AAA of North Dakota says as we enter the month of May, gasoline prices are nearing their seasonal high.
Yeah, we've been kind of spoiled the last couple of years, and now we're seeing gasoline prices continually moving higher to the highest point nationally since November of 2014.
Spokesman Gene LaDucer says the Memorial Day holiday weekend, or early June, normally marks the peak price for gasoline for the year. He says the climbing prices can be attributed to the exporting of American crude.
And there used to be a ban in place that we couldn't export crude oil, but that was lifted in late 2015, and since then we've seen crude oil exports continually rise until last week when we saw that record level. So, and we expect that to continue to increase.
LaDucer says the statewide average price of gasoline in North Dakota is $2.67 per gallon. Last year at this time, it was $2.34. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Maria Modi Tuya. She is a Fargo North High School senior, and more specifically for our chat today, she was the winner of the Poetry Out Loud North Dakota competition. And last week, she was in Washington, D.C. as one of the 9 finalists in the final round of the National Poetry Out Loud competition. Maria, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
How did you get interested in poetry?
So I started poetry when I was a freshman at North, and I didn't really know much about, you know, poetry. I know in class we would learn about it, but it was hard for me. You know, when you're a freshman and, you know, doing poetry, nobody really likes it, and it's it's hard, and, you know, so poetry wasn't like, you know, it didn't grab my attention until a friend of mine told me about it. She was like, "Oh, you'd be so good at it. Like, you know, you have a good voice for, you know, reciting and performing. You should really do it." So I was like, "You know, why not? Let's just try. Let's see what happens." So I joined the speech team at North freshman year, and that's when I got started. And I immediately became in love with it when I first recited The Type by Sarah Kay. I loved that poem. And so ever since then, I was like, you know what? This is the place for me. I really enjoy it. So,
how would you describe the kind of poetry that really grabs you, that you really want to recite?
Right. So I love poetry that tells, you know, a message that the world needs to hear, you know. I love giving people out messages and having them feel and think about life, and, you know, and I also love poems that tell stories, you know, and I love that, so.
Well, also, you must love words and sharing the words that move you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, words, when you put words together correctly to make them, you know, it makes it so much easier to say them out loud and you know, say it in a certain way that will move people.
Well, let's get a little sample of what you did, because this is a recording of April Love by Ernest Dawson, and this is one of the poems that you read in competition, mm-hmm. recited in competition at the North Dakota contest in Bismarck recently. Here it is.
April Love by Ernest Dawson. We have walked in love's land a little way. We have learned his lessons a little while. And shall we not pass at the end of day with a sigh, a smile? A little while in the shine of the sun, we were twined together, joined lips, forgot how the shadows fall when the day is done and when love is not. We have made no vows. There will none be broke. Our love was as free as the wind on the hill. There was no word said we need wish unspoke. We wrought no ill. So shall we not part at the end of day, who have loved and lingered a little while, joined lips for the last time, go our way with a sigh, a smile.
That's Maria Modi Tuya at the Poetry Out Loud North Dakota competition in Bismarck recently, reciting April Love by Ernest Dawson. Well, last week you were in Washington for the finals.
Yep.
One of the nine chosen from the nationwide competition with like 52 people. You were one of the nine for the final round. Describe the experience.
So I was very excited to go to Washington, D.C. and compete. First, because I love meeting new people. I got to meet the most talented, intelligent people ever, and it was a great time. And it didn't even feel like a competition because everybody was so supportive and, you know, complimenting each other. So it was just great. But I was so excited to perform because I love performing poetry in front of people. So that was the moment I was looking forward to perform in front of many, many, many people. So
it was streamed online, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
so
it
lots
was.
Of people could watch it. How was it judged?
So there was a few criterias. So first, it was judged on accuracy.
So somebody's following along, reading the text as you're reciting it?
Mm-hmm. Performance, appropriate dramatic drama, you know, dramaticness. And then I believe body language, voice and articulation.
And you brought the package, I guess, because you were, again, one of the finalists there.
Mm-hmm.
You have expressed an interest after high school of going into musical theater and that kind of thing?
Yeah, mainly theater. I used to do music, but I love,
You like to perform.
Perform, yes. So, yeah, I'm going to be going to MSUM, and where I really want to pursue theater and performing. So,
how did you prepare when you were getting ready for the finals in Washington?
Mm-hmm.
What was Maria Modi Tuya doing to, you know, get yourself mentally prepared for this kind of a performance?
So the first thing I did was I thank God, you know, for giving me this opportunity. Because I've come a long way in life, and to just kind of take a deep breath, breathe, remember why I'm here and what I want to get accomplished. And then I just think to myself, you know, Maria, you just have fun, because it's all about serving people and making sure that you tell the story and the message of these poems. And so before I performed, I made sure I did all of, you know, just reminded myself of all of those things, and then I was ready.
Well, the idea of performing that way in front of people and then being evaluated for it's very interesting. You referenced something else, though, that we should probably talk about, this journey you've been on, because you didn't start in Fargo.
No.
So tell our listeners about your family story.
Yeah. So my family's from South Sudan. I was born in Juba, Juba, South Sudan. And at the time, my family had to flee and go to Egypt because of the war that was going on. And so we moved to Egypt and, you know, we were basically refugees because, you know, we had to leave our country. And it was one of the hardest moments in my life and in my family's life. And so moving to the U.S. a little, a few months after living in Egypt was probably the hardest thing that my parents had to, you know, that we had to go through. Because first, we didn't speak English. You know, that was the number one thing. And then getting used to the lifestyle of, you know, living in the United States, we didn't really know much. And the fact that we moved to Fargo, North Dakota, you know, where it was extremely cold and, you know, something we were definitely not used to. So it was definitely a struggle for me and my family. And going to school, English was hard, you know.
You've mastered it. That's
Thank
for
you.
Sure. And your family, it's a large family. It's your parents have got six kids, so you're one of six children.
Yeah.
Now, that's no mean feat, moving a family that size to a place like this, and acculturating and learning a language and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The other part that I want to chat about is sort of related to all of this, and that's this Legacy Children's Foundation. You're on the board of directors for that. That's a local nonprofit here.
Yep.
Tell our listeners what Legacy Children's Foundation does.
Yeah. So the Legacy Children's Foundation is an organization to help middle school and high school students that are disadvantaged and, you know, it may be that their family struggles with, you know, food or education or whatever it may be. Like my family, you know, we definitely struggled with English and getting resources because it's just hard living in a country where, you know, you don't really know much and you don't really have a lot of money to support yourself. And many kids in Legacy were disadvantaged to any of those sort of things that might have prevented them from, you know, becoming successful. So the Legacy's mission is to, you know, seek diverse teens into achieving a high school diploma, you know. And so I was among those students that qualified to be in this organization. And I can say that, you know, it has impacted my life tremendously. And I don't know if I would be here, you know, speaking to you guys right now if it wasn't for this organization.
Well, I went up on the website, and everybody out there can check it out, legacychildrensfoundation.com. And there was a calendar up there, and there are activities for most of the days of the week, including homework help.
Yes.
And it's at specific schools around the town here. That in itself would seem to be a valuable resource.
Oh, yes.
For somebody who's trying to, you know, catch up.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely had to catch up. Ever since I went to Madison Elementary, I've been trying to catch up, and it was until sixth grade when I met Mary Jean Dean, and she introduced me to the Legacy Children's Foundation. And right away, I got help with my literacy, my math skills, and, you know, I spent multiple summers, you know, working on that. And it's definitely what's gotten me here today.
Well, let's leave people with another poem here. And this is The Waking, Theodore Ruffke, and you recited this poem in the national competition.
Yep. So this is The Waking by Theodore Rothke. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I feel my fate in what I cannot fear. I learn by going where I have to go. We think by feeling what is there to know. I hear my being dance from ear to ear. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Of those so close beside me, which are you? God bless the ground. I shall walk softly there and learn by going where I have to go. Light takes the tree, but who can tell us how? The lowly worm climbs up a winding stair. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Great nature has another thing to do to you and me. So take the lively air and lovely, learn by going where to go. This shaking keeps me steady, I should know. What falls away is always and is near. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I learn by going where I have to go.
Wow. I wish people could have seen you as you recited that poetry. From memory, incidentally, ladies and gentlemen, The Waking by Theodore Rothke. Beautifully done, Maria.
Thank you.
Obviously, you're interested in theater. And after college, you know, where do you see yourself in 10 years?
In 10 years.
Yeah, use your imagination and be good to yourself.
I definitely see myself either on the stage or on the big screen.
All right. Well, we'll look for you both places, I hope. Tell us about family life now. I mean, everybody's got – your parents are working. You've got kids or siblings who are around you as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, give us the two-year story here.
Yeah, so – my parents, Cesarina and John, they are very, very hardworking parents. And I have three sisters and two brothers. So my brother's off to college, but the rest of them live at the house. And when my parents heard about this, I've never seen them so happy in my life. You know, they were calling back home. They were getting many, many messages on Facebook like, "Oh, wow, your daughter, this." So they were so happy, and I'm just so glad that that I gave that joy to them because they deserve it.
Well, thank you for sharing it with us as well. I encourage our listeners to go online and seek out Maria Modi, that's M-O-D-I, Tuya, T-U-Y-A, and you'll see some videos of her reciting poetry. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Okay. Harvest Public Media is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Thank you for listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Harvest Public Media is exploring the potential changes in the next Farm Bill, a huge federal law that funds wide-ranging programs on and off the farm. One major program is crop insurance. In some ways, it's similar to other kinds of insurance, but as Amy Mayer reports, there are important differences.
Crop insurance protects a laundry list of farm products.
From corn to clams. Macadamia nuts.
Chad Hart is an ag economist at Iowa State University.
All sorts of things are covered by crop insurance.
There's a long history of federal programs to help farmers, but since the current Farm Bill became law in 2014, crop insurance has widely been seen as the primary federal safety net. Some farmers say it keeps them in business. Farmers like Corey Goodhue.
The financial risk that we take is enough to bankrupt us. Even with the equity we have, if you go that far negative cash flow, our business wouldn't sustain that without a safety net.
Goodhue says insurance on his corn and soybeans near Carlisle, Iowa, frees him up to lock in the best possible price in advance. Because if his harvest then doesn't go well, crop insurance lessens the blow. With birds chirping behind him, Goodhue says he's heard people say they think farmers are counting on annual payouts from insurance. That's not how he operates.
That doesn't make any sense to me as I walk through it. You know, it's a mechanism that protects us from losing our business. You know, it's not something that we're trying to make money doing.
He compares it to car insurance. After an accident, drivers file claims for their wrecked cars.
I think most people would say if they get a car insurance payout, they're almost never whole when it's done. Like, they're always better off to have not had the wreck.
It's a comparison that's also useful for understanding what's different with crops. If a bunch of people all have car insurance, the chances are pretty good that when one driver has an accident and files a claim, most of the others will not. The insurance company has no problem paying. But with crops, it's more likely many farmers will need a payment at the same time because of a flood or drought. Enter the federal government. It subsidizes crop insurance to make it appealing and affordable to both private companies and farmers. Goodhue says he pays about half his premium and the government picks up the rest, which is about average.
When you look at the risk versus the benefit, it pencils. If you took that subsidy away, I think we would not buy crop insurance.
Currently, no matter how big the premium, the government will split it. There's no limit. Some advocacy groups hoped the new Farm Bill would impose a $50,000 cap, but that doesn't seem likely. The House bill does very little to change the program. The insurance companies also get subsidies to help weather the years when tons of farmers have claims, like in 2012 when there was a major drought. At $13.4 billion, that year was the government's most expensive for crop insurance. By 2016, the tab had dropped to $4.2 billion, the second lowest in a decade. Aaron Herbold-Swalwell, an agricultural lawyer in West Des Moines, Iowa, says the Farm Bill makes rules around crop insurance, and if farmers don't follow them, they can lose their ability to get it.
We just don't know what's going to happen, but the best policy is to operate under the system that we have now and really do pay attention to those compliance issues.
Have you seen situations where crop insurance is what has kept a farm in business?
Oh, most definitely. I think if you didn't have crop insurance in this environment, you know, one bad event could be very, very devastating.
That brings up one last thing. Part of the justification for government subsidies is that crop insurance protects taxpayers, so they aren't footing the entire bill to help farmers after a disaster. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Here are a few comments from Prairie Public members who gave during our last member drive.
I'm often on the road, and Prairie Public keeps me company and keeps me awake. Thank you for the great programming.
I enjoy Main Street, Chuck Laura, and Tom Ezern. I also enjoy the News Chat. Thank you for hours of listening pleasure and great information about North Dakota.
I love everything about Prairie Public. I listen to it incessantly. That, and who can resist Dave Thompson's velvety voice?
From Main Street, National Native News, World Cafe, to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, so many favorites. And well worth $15 a month. Thank you for being there.
It rocks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For supporting Prairie Public.
And thanks to Prairie Public's very own Marie, Christine, Bobby, and Siobhan for reading those kind comments. If you'd like to become a sustaining member, it's so easy. Just go to prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 30th. Earlier this month, we heard about the retired bronze figurehead from the bow of the USS North Dakota, which had been sent to the state to be preserved and put on display. It was agreed that North Dakota would receive the figurehead as a perpetual loan, paying only $73 to ship the 3,240-pound object. However, 2 years later, in 1915, while Governor Hanna was away, the state auditor and the Secretary of State, both members of the Board of Trustees of Public Property, ordered that about one-third of the figurehead, mainly the portion that was not on display, be sold off. A little more than 1,000 pounds was sold as scrap to a junk dealer for $71, about $2 less than it had cost to ship the figurehead. The junk dealer, in turn, resold it in Chicago for a small profit. The Bismarck Tribune noted, "This bronze wasn't exactly the property of the state, nor had the Secretary of State nor the state auditor any authority to sell this government property and turn the money into the state treasury." The scandalous news spread quickly. Many citizens also questioned a rummage sale conducted by the state where many other items, such as revolving bookcases, desks, and leather couches, were sold fast and cheap. According to reports at the time, the sale of the unused portion of the figurehead, and possibly other items, was to reduce fire hazard at the Capitol. The Navy was alerted to the fate of the figurehead, and on this date, an investigation continued. In the meantime, newspapers across the state lamented the loss. With the ornamental work on and mounted in the proper manner, the figurehead is a thing of beauty and a joy forever. But the part of the figurehead which was mounted and placed on the Capitol grounds is a huge joke. Some have mistaken it for an imitation of the rock upon which our forefathers first set feet. And most of the visitors who have seen it have still to figure out what it represents. Today, what remains of the figurehead can be found on the Capitol grounds on the south side of the Heritage Center. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
When President Trump announced tariffs on steel and aluminum imports back in March, he had one country in mind.
The biggest problem is China. We lost $500 billion. How previous presidents allowed that to happen is disgraceful.
But those tariffs have caused a lot of uncertainty for many other countries. The side effects of Trump's trade war with China on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, we start a new month, so we'll hold our monthly Editor's Roundtable with Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson, and he'll be joined by Roundtable veteran Matt Von Panon, editor of the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead. We'll also welcome new guest Kimberly Wynn, the city editor of the Bismarck Tribune. We hope you can join us for Main Street and our Editor's Roundtable on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.